Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregenauer with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregen, and I have not only a great guest, and probably an especially great guest, although you all know from listening to this show that we have absolutely marvelous people from around the world, but I have a marvelous announcement to make. Yesterday, a Chicago jury awarded $1.5 million to an autistic child and his family because of a case of tardive dyskinesia and tardive akathisia while being treated by a psychiatrist with Risperdal and then Zyprexa. I was the psychiatric expert in the case. I testified last week. We got the verdict yesterday. The case will be up on my website within a day, and I'm going to be blogging about it. You'll be able to get more information in the next couple of days. Briefly, this was an autistic child who first saw a psychiatrist that we can identify shortly before he became 8 years old. He was already on an SSRI, the Zoloft. The Zoloft was continued, and he got worse and worse. The Zoloft was changed to Paxil, and he got worse and worse. He turned from being an autistic but gentle child who could communicate some and could respond to caring and warmth into an out-of-control, very unhappy, very difficult child, which is what the SSRIs commonly do to children. And when I say commonly, I am able to produce studies from Yale and Harvard and other places showing that up to half or more kids on SSRIs develop aggression, more withdrawnness, degrees of mania, even violence. These are very disruptive drugs to children in very large percentages, completely ignored, of course, by the establishment. So when, instead of removing him from his antidepressant, this autistic youngster, the doc put him on Risperdal. Then after several months, a year or two, he was taken over by another psychiatrist who continued him on Risperdal and then switched him to Zyprexa over a 2.5 year period. Until at the age of 15, he was in such bad shape and showing so many signs of tardive dyskinesia that he had to be taken off the drugs. And that unmasked a horrendous case of TD. Because, see, the drug, while it causes tardive dyskinesia, which are movement disorders, think of any muscle in your body you can partially control, including your voice and your breathing and your swallowing, or more traditionally, more commonly, your tongue, your mouth, your blinking, your hands and your toes and your fingers. And I mean, it's just, it afflicts anything, your torso, your diaphragm. This boy was described like he was playing the piano. His hands were moving so vigorously. Well, this is a tragic case. He ended up with such a terrible case of tardive akathisia, which is a horrible inner torture that drives the person to ceaselessly move around. Videos of him pacing, running around his kitchen in his mother's home at the age of 15. And finally, because the only thing that will control these extreme cases is more of the offending agent, he had to be put back on antipsychotic drugs. He has a very grim future ahead of himself. I testified, drew pictures on a board for the jury about how these drugs work. I testified that the doctor was negligent, the second doctor, the first doctor was not in the case, and that what a grim future he had. The other side, the defense attorneys, tried to depict me as an outsider, a person who, you know, shouldn't be listened to, but they listened. And when they were interviewed after giving this $1.5 million verdict, they said, "We didn't buy the way they were painting Dr. Breggin at all. We think they were really describing a hero." That's from the jury. And, you know, I don't boast a lot. I just feel like airing this one out. And they said they knew that there was too much drugging of kids going on, and they were so glad I was doing what I was doing. Folks, times are changing. People are knowing that something is dreadfully amiss in psychiatry, as it is. It's dreadfully amiss. So I'm just really happy. I'm proud. I think the fact that this was an autistic child and a child is going to just sound even louder, the warning about drugging kids. There really is no justification for giving a psychoactive substance to a child who already is having trouble relating to other human beings. It makes no sense to do that to a child and to the family, to further compromise the child's ability to relate. And in some cases, you're going to end up with these kinds of horrific disasters where a person who could have had a good quality of life is now constantly tortured by tardive akathisia. This is like such a tragedy, so dreadful. I'm really happy to have worked on this case. The attorney from Chicago is Francis P. Morrissey, Frank Morrissey, a marvelous man, a marvelous attorney. I hope this will be a bit more of a turning point on the drugging of our children. Now, I know that my wonderful guest. Are you there, Philip?
Hello, Peter. Yes, I am.
Oh, and you have a British accent. It's always charming. It makes me feel very international. It makes me feel like we're doing stuff around the world together. My guest.
I have the same feeling. Listening to an
you
American,
hear my,
I can tell
my
you.
My American accent. Oh, my God. I'm still exhausted from the trial. I won't go into how exhausting the trip in the snow was and how exhausting the trip back was and how exhausting it was to be on the stand. But what a marvelous event. Philip Thomas is a psychiatrist. He's a British psychiatrist. He's the founder or a founder of the Critical Psychiatry Network in Great Britain, which to my astonishment has 220 psychiatrists in their membership, and I'm one of a handful of Americans who is also a member, and I'm proud of it, of the Critical Psychiatry Network. He's a consultant psychiatrist, was working full-time in the National Health Service in Great Britain. I think he's doing more writing now, more publishing. He's got over 100 scholarly articles. His first book goes back to 1997, the Dialectics of Schizophrenia. He's got the two other books, including Voices of Reason, Voices of Insanity, co-authored. And now, Post-Psychiatry with Pat Bracken from Great Britain. And really, Pat's from Ireland, isn't he?
He is indeed, yes. Pat's back over in Ireland now.
I should know because he's really kind of a friend. Pat is also on the Advisory Council for the Empathic Therapy. So I'm really glad and delighted to have this marvelous man aboard. But before I really forgot something very important, Ginger would be very mad at me. We are having our first Empathic Therapy Conference of the year. It's going to be at the end of February. And in marvelous Tampa, Florida, right on the bay, and it's, gosh, I could have forgotten this in all my excitement. It's February 27th, 28th, and March 1. It's a joint, and we're doing this more and more, it's a joint conference with the Adlerian Society of Florida, folks I know and love well. On Friday the 28th, I'll be presenting and I'll be emceeing the entire day. So this really is a joint conference. And on Saturday, I'm going to do the plenary on Friday. And on Saturday, I'm going to do a workshop. So it's going to be our empathic therapy meeting of the start of the new year. You can find out more about it by going to empathictherapy.org. You can probably Google it, too. And so that's all exciting. So let me pick up now. The rest of the hour is going to be me and Dr. Philip Thomas. Hi, say something.
Hello.
Get us going.
Hello, Peter. Hi. Well, congratulations on the case. That's fantastic news. Well done.
Thank you. Thank you.
And,
I'm going to let you start, so just take a breath.
Okay, right. Well, would it be helpful if I just sort of set out a little bit of the background to the Critical Psychiatry Network in UK?
I'd love that.
Okay. Well, our first meeting was in January 1999 in Bradford, where Pat Bracken and I were working at the time. And I'd met Joanna Moncrief and a couple of others a year or so before at the Institute of Psychiatry, where I gave a paper. And they got together and came up to me afterwards and said, you know, this is really great stuff, and we have a sort of critical group down here. We really ought to get this moving. So we did. We had this meeting in Bradford. There were over 20 psychiatrists from across England, really, attended it. And I think there were a number of concerns that we had at the time. We were Tony Blair government had just been elected, and there was a great deal of concern about the proposals to introduce more coercive care in the community, so-called community treatment orders. I think there was also a lot of concern about the influence of the pharmaceutical industry on the profession, and the way in which so-called scientific evidence was being presented. Actually, wasn't scientific at all. It was cheap marketing for the industry. I think there was also a lot of concern about the role of evidence-based medicine in psychiatry, and especially the way in which debates about what was effective and what wasn't effective was being sort of swung in its own interests by pharma. We were, as I think I've indicated, also very concerned about the problems of coercion in psychiatry. There was a really strong feeling, and all these themes are still very much with us, and a very important theme, certainly for me and for Pat, was the growing feeling that biological psychiatry, neuroscience and genetics were simply completely sidelining and marginalizing the importance of understanding the meaning of people's experiences, trying to find meaning in people's experiences of intense distress and psychosis through looking at the histories of their lives, listening to them, talking about their histories, and looking at the context, the social, political, cultural, and other sorts of contexts in which their lives were held. So I think out of that, we decided there was a real need for us to start getting active. We meet regularly. We meet twice a year, usually once in London, once in the north of England. Over the years, it's a virtual network most of the time. It's an email list. We've now got, I think, over 220 members, most of whom are British psychiatrists, but of course there are people like yourself, and I think Brad Lewis in New York is also on the circulation list. Perhaps a couple of other American colleagues. Peter Stastny in New York is on the circulation list, and a number of continental psychiatrists, and also people in Australia and New Zealand. So it's becoming more international, but it's largely, I mean, it's very insular. It's a very sort of British thing. It's largely concerned with things that are troubling us and which you might want to hear me talk about shortly. The things we do, I mean, we've published a great deal along the themes that I outlined a moment ago. looked at the written output of critical people, colleagues, friends associated with critical psychiatry in UK a couple of years ago. And we've got something now like 10, 12, maybe 13 or 14 with Joe Moncrief's latest, The Bitterest Pills, books, published books. We've got something like 40-odd chapters in books, including at least two or three collected, edited sets of volumes, if you like, or collections of papers by critical psychiatrists and others, and in excess of 140 papers in peer-reviewed articles. So we're a prodigiously productive group, and I think we probably that's I think one of the most important reasons why our influence has spread. It's largely on account of the writing that we've done over the years. But we're not just about sitting in ivory towers doing our own thing, staring into the darkness of our interiorities. We do lots of other things as well. One of the things in particular we've done over the years, which I personally have enjoyed a great deal, is campaigning actively in alliance with survivors and service users against some of the worst excesses of psychiatry. So we've been on picket lines, and we've, for example, campaigned against the influence of the pharmaceutical industry at meetings of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. So we've been handing out leaflets to delegates going in, and then we've gone with survivors, with radical and activist survivors in UK, and then we've gone in and taken the battle into the halls of the conference itself. We've also campaigned against community treatment orders, and one of the things we're looking at the moment, although I'm not quite sure where we are with this, I know it's something we've spoken about a great deal, is the need for some sort of campaigning around or against the issue of ECT. We feel very strongly that this is a treatment that really is dangerous and harmful, and it shouldn't be used. So,
I don't know if you know that I've put up a huge website on electroshock treatment with well over 100 scientific articles, a brochure, an introduction. So I don't think word's gotten around about that. So,
oh, no.
Please,
I'd be great if you could send me the link for that.
It's ectresources.org. ectresources.org. Real simple. And it is everything you need to write an article, to talk to a parent. There's even a color brochure. I put in hundreds of hours into this. And,
Want
to get the word out.
Well, I know certainly in toxic psychiatry it was something you looked at in some detail, in depth, so I must chase that up.
Yes, have a look at it.
No, most definitely, yes.
So you're talking about CPN, the Critical Psychiatry Network. There's a big deal going on right now on the web, on our exchange of the emails about the psychiatric, College of Psychiatry, and some issues with Joanna Moncrief. Maybe tell the folks about that.
Yeah, no, I'd be delighted to. Jo's blogged about this on her own website, so you can see Jo's take on this. And I also just yesterday blogged an article on Bob Whitaker's site, Mad in America, about it, which sets out some of the background. What's happened is that Joe Moncrief put a proposal together for a symposium at the next 2014 annual Congress of the Royal College of Psychiatrists in London. And the Congress was really about, I can't remember what the title of it was, but it was... It was time to reappraise the use of neuroleptics or antipsychotic drugs. She'd got Lex Vondering over to talk about the seven-year follow-up from the Dutch first episode study that showed that people who came off, discontinued neuroleptics, had much better social outcomes. Now, of course, that's the first, to my knowledge, that's the first extensive long-term follow-up of people randomly allocated to antipsychotic drugs from the first moment they become ill, which is why it's of such great importance. And, of course, its results also are consistent with the other work. For example, Martin Harrow's excellent studies over many, many years in Chicago, following people up over 20 years, that shows broadly the same sort of things. So she got Lex von der Rinck over. She'd got none other than Professor Sir Robin Murray from the Institute of Psychiatry to talk about the massive accumulating evidence that neuroleptics cause brain shrinkage. And she herself was going to talk, I think, about the marketing and the increased pressure to market and to sell neuroleptic drugs. So she put this wonderful proposal together. You know, you would have thought this was something that everybody in the profession really ought to know about, that all psychiatrists involved in using these drugs would need to know about this information. There would need to be open democratic debate about it, not just within the profession, but also, indeed, in a democracy, in wider society, in people who are on these drugs, patient groups, survivors, carers, and other professionals, policymakers. You'd expect that there is a real need for a much wider debate, it seems to me, and to us, indeed, to Joe and to others, for a debate about these issues in relation to the use of these drugs. And this is one way within the profession of beginning to trigger a debate, stimulate a debate. Well, you can imagine the surprise she had, the unpleasant surprise she had, when she was informed by the organizing committee that they decided not to accept her proposal. I mean, she was astounded, and many of us indeed all of us, I think, in critical psychiatry were absolutely shocked by this. You know, Jo Moncrief is one of the, in Britain, she more than anybody else has done sterling work for many years now, sort of assiduously picking apart the scientific evidence on the effectiveness and safety of these drugs. Indeed, all psychiatric drugs. She's a recognized authority on this. So we were really dismayed and disappointed. And when she wrote to the organizing committee, the chair of, or one of the chairs, because I think there are three chairs, she was told, she said, why was it rejected? And she was more or less told that people didn't think it was of sufficient interest, or there were too many similar sorts of competing proposals which were similar to hers. So she wrote back and said, well, have you accepted one that's going to deal with these issues? And she still, that was, I think, at the end of December. She's still now in the middle of February awaiting a reply. So there's a great deal of unhappiness. And at the moment, we're in the process, I think, as you're probably aware, on some of the discussions that are taking place on the critical psychiatry email list, we're sort of wondering about, you know, where do we go from here and how do we take this forward. One suggestion has been that we go ahead and organize our own conference doing the same thing, which is fine, but the problem is the great strength of the Royal College's meetings is that that's where the, you know, that's the profession of psychiatry at prayer, if those two words, psychiatrist and prayer, go together in the same sentence. I don't think they actually do, but that's a separate issue.
Let me interrupt a minute, Phil, to comment on the fact that while it's a shock that the British Psychiatry Organization turned this down, this wouldn't have gotten even anywhere near this far in the USA. There isn't a group of psychiatrists with the equivalent status in the universities that the Critical Psychiatry Network has, including John Moncrief. And that, so people listening to the show here in the U.S. may be thinking, well, that couldn't even happen here. And that's true. It couldn't even happen here that you'd have this kind of conflict going on.
No, I don't fully understand. I think you need to be a sociologist and a historian to understand why that is. And you need to look at our different cultures and our different political systems and our different value bases. I think all those sorts of contextual factors, broader factors, probably account for that. I mean, we're really fortunate. I think, you know, of all the things I've done in my professional career, my involvement with critical psychiatry is one of the things I feel critical psychiatry is one of the most positive. And I think it's an immensely powerful, supportive organization. Having a body of colleagues who share the same values, share the same general beliefs. I'm not saying we agree about everything, but in broad terms, we do. And that is enormously liberating and enormously powerful. And we gain, I think, enormous mutual strength to support each other in taking these sorts of steps, in challenging the orthodoxy. And, it takes time to build up. We've been at it for 15 years, and we've come quite a long way. I think there's so much further we could go. But, you know, if this isn't something that happened overnight, it's something that a lot of people have worked very, very hard at and put a great deal of commitment of their professional lives into this. And I think it's been well worthwhile. I just exhort you and all your colleagues to start. I think start something up. I think Brad Lewis. I met a few people in Philadelphia back in October last year at an APA meeting, and I'm pretty sure that. There is interest in doing a similar thing over in UK with people like Brad Lewis and Carl Cohen and Kenneth Thompson, but I'm not sure where they are with it at the moment.
Well, I'm proud to be affiliated with you in Great Britain, and folks were talking about the possibility of some sort of a joint conference for two. Sure. It's really in the talking stages for 2016 in Great Britain on. Where maybe I'll come over and we'll do something with the Emphatic Therapy Conference and perhaps with CPN, the Critical Psychiatry Network, and other British groups. There's been a marvelous coming together in the recent months between myself and the British. I'm probably more guilty than anybody else for not reaching out as much as I could. I've known and loved Joanna Moncrief for decades, but I haven't been terribly involved with Europe, and that's changing now. The whole scene around the world is beginning to change in a positive
and
way.
And I think, if I can just say here, that I think Joe's work on drugs and medication and their problems, the problems associated with it, has actually helped us to move in a position over here where we can see much more clearly the value of the message that this is a message that you've been espousing for God knows how many years, long before critical psychiatry was established. So I think it's really good that the work that's beginning to emerge over here now is beginning to open up our eyes to the value of the work that you've been doing for so long. And as you say, it means we're able to start building links and bridges. And I think that's really, really valuable and important. It is so important. This is seen to be not just a local movement, but it has international implications as well.
Well, this is all really exciting, what's happening out there in the world. The victory yesterday in our malpractice suit in Chicago for $1.5 million on tardive dyskinesia. And folks, I'm doing a lot of very exciting, but at this point, not publicized legal work, too, that I may be sharing with you. I hope I'll be able to share with you in the coming months.
Fantastic.
We'll go to break now, and when we come back, my guest, Philip Thomas, Great Britain, an MD, a psychiatrist, let's talk more about your specific interests and your specific work when we come back. How about that?
Okay, that sounds like a good idea.
Okay, my marvelous engineer, Giselle, let's go to break. And this is Peter Bregan. I'm in an ebullient mood. What does that word mean? Boiling over with joy. It's just been a remarkable day for me learning about yesterday's Tardive Dyskinesia victory, $1.5 million. I'm just looking right now at the official signed jury verdict that's on file. It's just heartwarming to see that. And now I've got my marvelous guest from Great Britain visiting with me and with you, Philip Thomas, psychiatrist, physician, MD. Hi, Philip. How are you over there? You were worried about having a big storm today interfering
with you. We're in the
middle.
Yeah, we're in the middle of a big storm right now. It's the wind is howling at 60 miles an hour over the tops of the Pennines in the north of England where I live. And, I mean, we're fortunate. People in the southwest of England are being buffeted and under floods, really. So, but we're okay at the moment. So
what sort of place do you live in? Are you out in the country?
Yeah, we live up in the in the Pennines, the hills in the called the backbone of England, which between I suppose Manchester and Leeds, but we're well connected with rail and road, so it's easy to get about, and it's really beautiful. There's lots of fine open moorland to walk on. We're very close to what, the area that's known as the Bronte Country, Wuthering Heights, just 6 miles up the road. It's that sort of mountain, hilly moorland area. It's really beautiful.
Well, be safe. We're not hearing any interference. You're on a hard line, I guess, there.
We are, yes.
All right. Yeah, you sound really good and clear. Tell the folks about maybe your book, Post Psychiatry, with Pat Bracken,
sure.
and just sort of cutting-edge thinking you're personally doing in psychiatry.
Well, Pat and I started working together in Bradford in 1997, and at the same time we started writing once every 2 months column in the magazine Open Mind, which sadly is no more. It's the Mind, which is the main sort of NGO for mental health in England. Mind, it was Mind's like sort of in-house magazine. And we struggled about what we were going to call this. So in the end, we decided on this term post-psychiatry, which was actually an expression used a year or so earlier by one of Britain's leading survivor activists, Peter Campbell, in a chapter he wrote in a book. And he coined this expression, post-psychiatry. And anyway, what Pat and I started to write about, I suppose, is really the problems that faced psychiatry, scientific psychiatry, biomedical psychiatry, and technological psychiatry in a sort of advanced liberal democracy with all the sort of problems that's associated with that. And I suppose there are sort of three or four main elements to this, which we developed, really started setting out first in a paper we published in the British Medical Journal in 2001. My God, is it as long ago as that? And in essence, what we argued in that paper was that across the Western world, faith in science and technology and its ability to solve and resolve human problems was really waning. There are many complex reasons for that. And secondly, that this sort of loss of faith in technology and science poses a particular problem for medicine, and especially for psychiatry. Because of the problems there are, as we know, about the validation of diagnostic concepts, so when psychiatry has been struggling for 150 years, it still is unable to validate scientifically a single category of its diagnoses, with the possible exception of dementias. And so what we argued was that psychiatry really also has to move beyond what we called a modernist framework, a framework that had been inspired and driven by scientific understandings, in order to reach out and engage with another really important development, and that is the rise of the survivor and the service user movements. And that until that time, really, psychiatry had carried on as though it had the sole right and authority to speak about the experiences of madness and distress when people experience psychosis, and that it didn't have to, because it believed it's in its own legitimacy, it believed that it had the right to make these pronouncements to account for madness in this particular way. It didn't have to engage with the understandings that service users and survivors had. So it was really important, it seemed to us, that we tried to move the whole debate in psychiatry forward in a way that actually made it a much more positive task for psychiatrists to listen to and to work with survivors and service users. And I suppose in trying to articulate those arguments, which we did most comprehensively in the book we published together in 2005, Post-Psychiatry, Mental Health in the Postmodern World, we tried to set out, I suppose, a set of comprehensive philosophical frameworks for that. And this is the point at which, if people say, what's the difference between critical psychiatry and post-psychiatry, I'd say there are probably more similarities than there are differences. But if you want to look for a difference, I think it would be fair to say that post-psychiatry is much more engaged with and concerned for certain strands of continental philosophical thought, and in particular, I suppose I'd be referring here to the philosophy of Heidegger, of Maurice Merleau-Ponty, the sort of hermeneutic phenomenologies, if you like, those approaches to human experience that foreground experience, that don't look at it in causal or scientific terms, and actually try to seek for the meaning of people's experiences. And two other important strands of philosophical thought that have influenced both of us is the sort of historical analyses and philosophy of the French thinker Michel Foucault, who I think is probably one of the most important, as far as psychiatry is concerned, one of the most important philosophers of the 20th century. And finally, of course, Ludwig Wittgenstein. Now, I've tried to read his first great work, Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, and it completely defeats me. Fortunately, his later work, Philosophical Investigations, not easy to grapple with, but there are profound insights, and there are some excellent scholars who've written commentaries on Wittgenstein's work that actually draw out a completely different way of understanding and thinking about experience, consciousness, the contents of consciousness, mind, that sets it much more in a social, in a contextual, and in an anthropological framework. In fact, later Wittgenstein has greatly influenced some schools of anthropology. So not everybody in critical psychiatry would necessarily say they gained inspiration from those philosophers, but I think it's fair to say that those are the philosophers that have certainly been really important in thinking through, for Pat Bracken and myself, some of the problems of psychiatry. And I suppose in practical terms, what does it all mean? First of all, it means that we work directly, I think, to foreground the importance of meaning in relation to the context of people's lives. So what that means in practice is not necessarily making a diagnosis unless somebody asks you for one. So I wouldn't say I'm necessarily opposed to diagnosis, but I don't see diagnosis as being the most important thing that you do with somebody. If somebody wants a diagnosis, they can have it, because some people undoubtedly do find diagnoses helpful. But the majority of people, probably, once they're over the acute overwhelm of psychosis, are really trying to struggle to make sense out of it. And that's where I think our attempt to work with people in ways that focus on meaning. And And in that respect, I think one of the most important developments in recent years has been a growth of interest in narrative and the use of narrative methods in psychiatry. And of course, you have in New York, Brad Lewis, who's written a really fine book about narrative psychiatry, which has certainly influenced my thinking a great deal. And so that's one aspect. Secondly, it prioritizes ethics over technology, and I can give you a concrete example of that. In order to foreground the ethical basis of clinical practice in teamwork in psychiatry, what Pat Bracken did when he set the home treatment service up in Bradford in 1996 was to appoint a service user development worker as the first person into the team. And that person, the wonderful guy called Peter, I've forgotten Peter's surname, but Peter Relton. And he was involved in the appointment of all other staff. Mm-hmm. He attended all team meetings. He helped really to focus the entire team discussion away from one of diagnosis and treatment, much more to one of what is this person's concern.
Mm-hmm. This is very similar, I think, to our recent show, folks, that you may have listened to with Joanna. No, not Joanna Moncrief, but with the that wonderful psychologist from South England. Oh my gosh, this is terrible. Who was just on the show? Oh God,
Lucy Johnson.
No? Yeah, Lucy Johnson was Lucy Johnson was talking about trying to implement this in the National Health Service, where the team gets together and talks about the story of the individual that they're trying to help rather than the diagnosis, and
tries
to involve the individual in telling their story.
Absolutely. Well, I think this in essence is what Pat and I were doing in Bradford back in the days of home treatment. And in those days, we didn't call it narrative because there wasn't such an, you know, the idea of narrative psychiatry hadn't sort of come out. But there's been a growing interest in narrative in medicine over the last 20 years. And in the last 10 years, that's really begun to get into psychiatry with the publication of Brad Lewis's book. And I've written wrote a paper about this in Medical Humanities last year with Eleanor Longdon, and it features prominently in the book I'm just about.
You know, Joanna mentioned to me something I'd forgotten, I think, on the radio show, which is when I visited Great Britain, I guess I've been there a few times, but this is probably 15 years ago or so, someone asked me, what would I replace diagnosis with? And I said, the person's story.
Absolutely.
And helping
them
change their story to make it come out better.
Yeah,
and I think that's the same thing, right?
It is. It's exactly what this is about. It's an alternative way of working for mental health professionals and psychiatrists particularly. And indeed, I mean, just to be clear, Lauren Mosher famously said when he wrote his letter of resignation from the APA back in, I think it was 1998, this isn't a case of me leaving the APA. This is a case of the APA having left me behind years ago because it became much more biological. And I think Lauren, bless him, when he said that, uttered a real truth that many of us, when I trained in psychiatry in Edinburgh in the late 1970s and the early 1980s, I wasn't taught that diagnosis was a part of it, but it wasn't the all-encompassing, most important thing. It was actually about making a formulation. And looking back, I've been looking back with interest at some of the stuff that was written back in the early 80s in some of the psychiatric journals in England about formulation. And it's clear that this was actually a form of narrative. It was actually trying to understand through the eyes of the person how it had come about that this person was in this particular state of crisis at this particular moment. And this involved looking not just at biological factors, it involved in looking at the person's life history, what had happened to them in their childhoods, about the sort of social factors that were operating in their lives at the time. So I think there has always been a strong narrative theme in not just psychiatric, but all of medical practice. More generally, I think one can see the growth of interest in narrative.
Well, yeah, if you go back and look at all medical articles years back, they too were discursive and descriptive, and it's just amazing. I mean, it's understandable that in medicine that may have been lost to some extent, but in psychiatry, we've lost the what we used to call case studies. We've completely lost that concept. It's not in the journals anymore. Instead, somebody writes an article saying, and it's all statistical analysis, you never get a single sense of whether anybody actually said they benefited.
And this is, it would be fine if it were pucker science, but it isn't. It's just nonsense. Some of the stuff that's published in the psychiatric journals these days.
Well, all of it almost.
Hmm?
Really, all of it, pretty much.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I get the British Journal of Psychiatry. They will insist. I'm a fellow of the college. They will insist on sending me this slim down, yellow, anemic-looking rag once a month. And I can get it online anyway. I immediately recycle it. It goes into the recycling skip I have in my office. So it would just save so much resources, energy, and trees if they didn't bother sending it out.
I think it's really helpful for people to know that during our training. Now, things changed earlier here. I mean, we got worse faster than you. You're sort of trying to catch up with us on getting worse while you're also trying to be a leader in getting better. So that's so interesting. I mean, your academy is trying to outdo us, catch up with us in being terrible. Now you've got the marvelous CPN, Critical Psychiatry Network, that's trying to make things better and ahead of us and making things better. It's an interesting sort of confluence of things going on in England right now.
But I think the part of the difficulty is in comparing the two. We started from very different positions. I mean, American psychiatry was dominated throughout the early part of the 20th century up until about the 1970s when Robert Spitzer got his teeth into DSM-3 by psychoanalysis. And that's all been so well documented by academics. I think Bob Whitaker's written some excellent stuff about that, and various others have as well.
The shift, Philip, the shift actually began earlier because in 1962, when I applied to be a resident at Harvard's Massachusetts Mental Health Center, I was interviewed by psychoanalysts and a marvelous family therapist. And 6 months or so later, when I arrived in 1962 for my first year of residency at Harvard, they had expurgated the psychoanalysts, expunged the therapist, and declared that from now on psychiatry was going to be, literally, they said this, Jerry Clareman, the director of residency training, said to this to me, from now on it's going to be computer diagnosis and drugs.
Good Lord.
That change actually coalesced in about 62,
wow.
and was a conscious political decision. It had nothing to do with science at all.
No, sure. But, I mean, there were, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm not an expert on the history of American psychiatry, and I'm not claiming to be, but my understanding has been that many of the authorities seem to locate the fundamental change with the publication of DSM-3 in 1980 and Robert Spitzer's
work.
That's
much too late. You see, by the time you get these guys to formulate it all for DSM, the perking has been going on for a decade and a half.
Right.
So at the very latest, you might date it to 72 when you start getting into all this biochemical theorizing going on. And
sure.
You get these research scientists collaborating with the drug companies and making up this stuff about how receptors in the brain are going to be related to psychiatric disorders. But the roots of this really go back to the early 60s,
right,
when psychiatry began to see that it couldn't compete with psychologists and social workers on their terms. It had to move radically to a biological model. It really does go back quite a bit earlier. That DSM was powerfully important, but it's the flowering of stuff that had been going on.
For a while, right.
For a while, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not a historian. I lived the history.
No. Sure. No, absolutely. And don't get me wrong, I'm not questioning you, and I defer to your experience of this, of course. But the other thing I suppose that comes out of this for me is that whereas in America, debates and discourses around psychiatry and psychosis and so forth have been quite clearly polarized between psychoanalytic and biological. And they've swung, you know, dramatic shifts over the course of 20 odd years, let's say, from the 60s into the 80s. With the in Britain, it's never been the same. The buzzword that we were all taught to respect and admire as young British trainees in psychiatry in the 70s, in the 60s and 70s, and certainly when I trained in the 70s, was psychiatry is an eclectic discipline. And there was a great deal of, I think, in those days, pride at the fact that British psychiatrists felt very much at ease talking about the importance of psychoanalytic theories or psychodynamic theories. I had experience in object relations theory, psychoanalytic psychotherapy when I was a trainee, with biological models, with social models. And when I was a lecturer for 3 years in Edinburgh, and I was told by one of my professors, right, you've got to give them all lectures on Heidegger and existentialism. And I was really
interested.
That was
not going on in the United States.
No, so but what's happened is that it's all those other things have been lost now from British psychiatry, and it's
You're really following our footsteps in that regard. But I'm so glad to see this huge backlash that you're way ahead of us on. Listen, to show you how bad it was in 62, I was in a case conference on a ward, and the visiting case conference leader just happened to be the head of the Boston, former head of the Boston Psychoanalytic Society, and the former commissioner, or maybe future commissioner of mental health, the most powerful man in psychiatry, maybe in the country, and certainly in Massachusetts. Uh-huh. And I brought up the work of the psychologist Carl Rogers.
He looked
at me in front of a bunch of young psychiatrists and nurses and other people, and he said, could we confine our remarks to psychiatry and psychiatric literature? So that's how bad it had already gotten in the U.S. in 62, let alone discussing Heidegger.
Goodness me.
We've got a minute or two left, 2 minutes, a minute and a half. Say something positive about where British psychiatry is going. I think that might be a nice way to end.
Well, I think one of the really exciting things about British psychiatry is that I know that colleagues involved with critical psychiatry are really doing some fantastic work and taking on board some of the work that's come out of groups like the Hearing Voices Network. So I've got colleagues who are working closely with Hearing Voices groups, not in a sort of neo-colonialist manner, but actually really trying to support them and to help them to get them off the ground. I think there are also some really interesting and exciting developments. One of our colleagues over here, Rex Haig, who's...
Coming to an end because the music is playing.
Okay.
Let me finish up. This is Philip Thomas. You can easily Google him. Just say Philip Thomas, MD, psychiatrist, Great Britain. His new book is Post-Psychiatry with another one of our advisory council members at the Empathic Therapy Center, Pat Bracken. I'm so glad to hear about the interesting stuff going on in Great Britain. I'm so happy be a growing part of it. Philip, it's a pleasure to be working with you.
Great,
thank you.
Great to talk to you. And my latest book is called Psychiatry in Context, Experiencing Meaning in Communities, and it's on the shelves in June this year.
Great work. Thank you for being on my hour.
Thanks a lot, Peter. Great to talk with you. All best.